there once again, and welcome to another episode of Musings on Golf. My name is Kelly Elbin, and along with my co-host Bob Bupka, we'll look at the three-peat that Nelly Korda did pull off on Sunday, and the one that Scottie Scheffler almost pulled off the same day. We'll also hear some really good stories from the outstanding amateur, Stuart Hagestad, who has won the U.S. mid-amateur three times and will be playing next week in his third Masters. Hey, Bob, lots of threes to discuss. And I have to tell you, as we celebrate amateur golfers in this episode, I was quite impressed with the insights from Stuart Hagestad.
And so was I. I mean, fascinating individual, obviously extremely intelligent, yes. But has a real deep-seated love and passion for the sport of golf. And, I think he handles it the right way. He's got no desire to be a professional. He certainly, I would believe, based on his amateur record, the talent to join the professional ranks. But he's perfectly content to be an amateur and playing some of the greatest golf courses in the world on some of the greatest teams. So he was great. And I think our listeners are going to really enjoy our chat with Stuart.
Yeah, he was a good collegiate player at University of Southern California, but the way the USGA put the U.S. mid-amateur in play back in 1981, it allows those guys who are no longer of the college age, so the 25 and over, to really have a chance to win a national championship. And, this guy, he's absolutely outstanding. He's coming off a win just recently at the Azalea Invitational, which is another big amateur event, played at the Country Club of Charleston. He last fall, Bob, played on his fourth Walker Cup team, all of them winning teams. He won the Crump Cup, which is a big time event at Pine Valley last year. And Bob, in his first Masters appearance in 17, not only did he make the cut, but he tied for 36. I expect him to play pretty well this week, next week.
Yeah, I think he's going into it with a lot of confidence. I think our listeners will be interested in hearing as he discussed the famous crow's nest where amateurs get to stay at Augusta. He takes us inside for a look that very few of us will ever get.
Yeah, it's true. And, in a few minutes, we're going to talk about a very special pat on the back and hug that you received, call out at the event, the tour event in Houston. But before we do that, before we talk about the Texas Children's Houston Open, man, kudos to Nelly Korda, Bob. She won her third straight LPGA start, winning the Ford Championship in Arizona. She's just one of five all-time who've won three times before the 1st of April, and the first American to do so since 1980. And while she was winning, Lexi Thompson, as much as we talk about Lexi and a lot of people root her on, she's still winless now. It's 77 events since her last victory in June of 2019. But right now, Nelly Korda, boy, she is at the top of the LPGA tour game.
She's very strong. She's strong off the tee. She's great around the greens. And you need all of those to, put up three wins in a row. It's tough enough to win once. Just ask Lexi Thompson. I mean, who I think very shortly is going to win again. She's not only a fantastic golfer, she happens to be a wonderful person off the golf course, as sweet a person as you ever hope to meet. And we hope she gets back in that winner's circle very shortly.
And the winner's circle goes to Steven Yeager, the German, who played his collegiate golf at the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga, his first win on the PGA Tour. Bob, I guess in a way, right, it was handed to him, you could say. How about that 2.5-foot putt that Scheffler missed at the end of the third round in 18, and then what everyone thought would be, a 5-footer or so that he would hold out and take it to sudden death on Sunday. But you know what? He didn't make them. And nine straight pars down the stretch for Yeager. It's the guy who won six times on the Korn Ferry Tour. So he knows how to win. Hats off to him. Sure, it would have been nice for Scottie Scheffler to win that third straight tour event, but he's still number one in the world. And boy, you've got to like his chances going into Augusta.
Yeah, I think he's got to be the odds on favorite. Although I still keep getting these nagging feelings about Rory McIlroy. We'll have to wait and see. And there's another guy that I'm going to toss out there. This is an early look at the Masters. Cam Young, I know he has trouble putting, but he is so long and so powerful. I think he's probably won Rookie of the Year, and he's finished. I think he has at least 7 second place finishes. Wouldn't surprise me if he comes out of nowhere and wins the Masters.
And yeah, he's still seeking that first win on tour. For Steven Yeager, winning for the first time on the PGA Tour, let's hear what that meant to him.
It feels amazing. I couldn't have dreamed up a better week to do it. Obviously, we playing Scotty last couple of days. He's been on a tear. So to kind of slay the dragon a little bit this week was amazing. And he's such a good dude, such a good player. I was just happy to play with him a couple of days. But I'm excited to kind of get on that next level and compete in majors and do all that kind of stuff. That's been my goal for a few years now. So, like I said, super excited, obviously, this week to get it done. And, yeah, have a great rest of the year.
Well, he's going to be playing in the Masters now. And our own Kelly Elbin, it wasn't the Masters, but it was Apogee, a fantastic golf property that's being developed down in Florida. From what I hear, it is incredible. Kelly, you were lucky enough to take a pair of William and Harry golf shoes on Apogee.
Yes, sir.
Where's the golf course?
Well, the property is extraordinary. We had Mike Davis, the former CEO of the United States Golf Association, on not too long ago. And Mike and Tom Fazio II, are the two drivers of this, if you will. The financing coming from Michael Pascucci, who's the owner of Sabonic Golf Club in Southampton, Bob, as well as Stephen Ross, who's the owner of the Miami Dolphins. But an amazing place. We had a chance, a good buddy of mine, AJ Walker, who's a much better player than I am, we had a chance to play the West Course, which Gil Hance designed. I like it. It's interesting. A number of drivable par fours, some short par threes, no water on the golf course. And I think that's the thing. They're creating 3 golf courses, over 1,200 acres of property, 6-star amenities, what they're saying. And I don't doubt it at all. I mean, you've got a clubhouse that's being constructed, I think, in the neighborhood of 72,000 square feet. You'll have 30-plus luxury villas. This is a top-of-the-line golf clubs. And you're going to have 2 other types or different kinds of golf courses there. Tommy Fazio and Mike Davis are working on the South Course, which will open in December of this year. Very different look than what Gil put together. And then Kyle Phillips, another outstanding golf course architect, is slated to open the North Course in December of 2025. Bob, this location in South Florida, in Hobe Sound, Florida, is going to really kind of reshape what the apogee, the top of what the golf experience can be for those who can afford it. It's a hefty price tag to get in, but what a place.
Yeah, and I want to draw our listeners' attention to the fact that you said 1,200 acres.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the golf course that Reese Jones designed out on Long Island, 18 holes on 55 acres. So we've had the pleasure of experiencing that. Completely different when you can get an 18-hole golf course on only 55 acres. Great job there by Reese Jones. A great event in Houston last week. We talked about it. Certainly Yeager going to love Houston from now on. You're right when you said we kind of thought Scotty may get the job done. Unlike him to miss that short, maybe 2.5 feet on Saturday, really hurt him. And then I think the whole golfing world thought that he was going to roll that 5-footer in on Sunday, force a playoff. But that's the beauty of golf.
Well, the beauty of golf also is the history of the game and recognizing those who have given back to the game in so many ways. And you had a lovely experience out there earlier in the week with Commissioner Jay Monahan. What if you could talk a little bit about that, Bob, and how cool that was, how much that meant to you to be back out there among friends and to hear the words from Jay?
Well, it certainly was a total surprise. We were invited into a media outing, and some pretty heavy hitters were up on the stage, like none other than the mayor of Houston himself, the owner of the Houston Astros, Jim Crane, also the director, a CEO of Texas Children's Hospital, a fellow by the name of Mark Jackson, real nice guy. And Texas Children's Hospital does a lot of amazing work. And also up there was none other than the commissioner of the PGA Tour, Jay Monahan. And the moderator asked Jay Monahan to open up the proceedings. He promptly takes the microphone and he said, "Before we start, I want to introduce somebody that's sitting in the audience. His name is Bob Bupka. He's been the longtime voice of PGA Tour Radio." At that point, Janice is picking me up off the floor because never experienced anything like that in the past. And it was mighty kind of the commissioner to dish out that recognition.
Well, well-deserved. And let's hear exactly what Commissioner Monahan had to say about one Bob Bupka.
I also want to recognize Bob Bupka, who's down here to my right, one of the voices of the PGA Tour. And it's great to be with you, Bob. Thanks for being here today. Appreciate you.
How much did that mean to you?
Well, it really meant a lot because, you know, he's the commissioner of the PGA Tour. And to be recognized like that and acknowledged by the other members of the media, it was a very, very special occasion for me.
Well, before we get to Stuart Hagestad, as I mentioned at the outset, I sort of look at this week as sort of a celebration of the amateur golfer. We've got the Augusta National Women's Amateur Thursday, Friday, Saturday, the first two rounds at the Champions Retreat Golf Club in Augusta. And then, of course, Thursday and Friday, rather. And then Saturday on NBC is the final round at Augusta National Golf Club. This is the fifth Augusta National Women's Amateur. Ingrid Lindblad is the number one ranked player among the women collegiate right now, and she'll be in that field. Rose Zhang won the event last year. Of course, she's turned professional and won her first tour event. But what a spectacular way for Augusta National Golf Club to celebrate the women's game. And then, Bob, 10th anniversary of the drive, chip, and putt with 80 finalists ranging from age 7 to 15 on Sunday morning on Golf Channel. Augusta National figured it out, Bob, after all the years of some negative publicity, and some of it perhaps deserved. They're the shrine of golf now. They are the mecca of golf with these events. Augusta National Women's Amateur, drive, chip, and putt, and then you kick off the week of the Masters. What a triumvirate that is.
It really is. And when you combine the magnitude of those events and then have them contested over the finest 18 holes of golf property probably anywhere in the world, probably certainly the most familiar. I mean, I doubt there's anybody that plays this game that doesn't know about that par 3 12th hole and everything that's wrapped around the Masters. It kicks off the major season, only one of four majors, and certainly a lot at stake because the winner gets invited back until he's 60 years old, and that is quite a surprise. And you get to go into the dinner on Tuesday night, the Champions Dinner, which everybody says is beyond belief because you're having dinner with the legends and the current guys that win. If there was ever a dinner I could be invited to, boy, that would be the one. I don't like my chances.
Unfortunately, I don't like them either. But the next step from that is the amateur dinner, which you will hear Stuart Hagestad talk all about, as well as his experiences at Augusta National and well beyond, right after these messages. Just like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry, and you should too. Folks, I love these golf shoes. They're made of deer skin and calf skin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William & Harry.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number. And more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game. So you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Bob, the legendary Bobby Jones, was the greatest amateur golfer of all time. And through the Masters tournament that he created and nurtured, the talents of amateur golfers continues to be recognized and celebrated. And among the outstanding amateur golfers today is our guest today, Stuart Hagestedt, who will make his third Masters appearance next week. Three times Stuart has won the U.S. Mid-Am, and four times he has prevailed as a member of the U.S. Walker Cup team. Oh, and by the way, he turns 33 on the eve of the Masters next week. Stuart Hagestedt, welcome to Musings on Golf. How are you, man?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Hey, Stuart. Bob Bupke here. Just like to ask you, is the anticipation for your third Masters anywhere near the level it was for your first Masters?
I think the answer is yes, but I'm maybe a little bit more comfortable with the idea that I'm playing in the tournament in April than I was the first time. You know, obviously everyone kind of knows the expression, you know, prior results don't necessarily indicate future results. The first time around, I was definitely a little bit more just anxious for, you know, the opportunity to play, and there's a lot of uncertainty. And I think that as I've gotten older, I've become a little bit more comfortable with that idea. You know, what happened in September happened, and, you know, we've had this amazing opportunity to go up there and to play in the tournament and to test our game against the world's best. And I'm just looking forward to that opportunity, and obviously thankful for the opportunity to go out there and to compete.
You know, knowledgeable golf fans everywhere always hear about the crow's nest where you get to stay. Is that closer to a palatial Fifth Avenue apartment or a college dorm room?
I think if you were to talk about kind of the intangible value and memories that are created up there, it's definitely much closer to a Fifth Avenue apartment. That's a very special place, and I've had the chance to spend the night up there a couple times, and, you know, obviously just to see it, and then, you know, twice to kind of watch NCAA, the final game of the NCAA tournament up there, because it always takes place on that Monday night. You have the opportunity to stay there the whole week, but in the past, I had stayed there after the amateur dinner. I may pivot that this year and spend the night up there on Sunday night, just when there's likely going to be less folks, you know, of the other amateurs that are in the field, but, you know, kind of paying respect to the tournament and to, you know, Mr. Bobby Jones and Mr. Clifford Roberts to have that space up there be designated for the amateurs. You know, I think it would be kind of a disservice to not only the event, but the invitation as an amateur to not spend the night up there. So I'm looking forward to it. And they've got these really cool, like gin and bridge kind of scorecards. So if any of the kids know how to play bridge, you know, it's you can bring it. I doubt it, but let's see.
You know, so much is made of the champions dinner on Tuesday. You referenced the amateur dinner. When is that held? Where is it held at the, I'm assuming at the clubhouse, and what's it like?
The amateur dinner is great. It's usually you have a choice of chicken or steak, which is probably what I would have ordered if I had my choice anyways. So that's great. Yeah. Great wine. There's an open bar, so that's great. Same thing, it's an intimate setting. There's a great group of members from the club that show up. It's hosted by a guy named John Carr, who was Joe Carr's son. Joe Carr played in 11 Walker Cup teams, and, you know, with the exception of literally probably Sigel, and then obviously if you go back in history, you know, a lot of kind of the infant, you know, players and captains of the Walker Cup, he's probably, you know, the most prolific Walker Cupper of all time. So Joe kind of runs it. And then there's a bunch of members on the side of Augusta. And then there's a bunch of RNA guys guys and gals, members that kind of show up, and, you know, leaders that are there, executives. Same with the USGA, just people from around the game. And it's a great group. There are people that at 25, I didn't totally, you know and understand. And, you know, everything's kind of brand new, and you're just trying to introduce yourself to as many people as possible. And I'll certainly do the same this year, but, you know, now, you know, a couple more of the players just because there's a few more familiar faces. But it's a great night. There's always a kind of a keynote speaker to talk and to tell stories about, you know, what it was like when either they played as an amateur or maybe they played in the tournament, you know, the first time or two. It's a great night.
What night? And is it in the same room as the champions dinner?
It's on Monday night. Champions Dinner, I believe, is on Tuesday night. And then it's held in a room. It's tough to describe unless you've been on property, but it's kind of right behind the main dining room. There's like an event space that they created. I say event space, it's like a big room. It's literally right next to, there's this little bar area that a lot of members will kind of go to before eating dinner if they want to just kind of catch up. Yeah, it's great.
And let me ask you this, Stu. If you go on to win this year's Masters, next year, will you be going to dinner on Monday night and Tuesday night?
Yeah, I will be. That's the plan.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
No, but you have to, but you would have to pay for the Tuesday dinner, right?
I'm more than happy to pay for the Tuesday dinner.
Whereas the Monday dinner is what provided by the club, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet you would be more than happy.
I would be more than willing to eat.
Joined by the great amateur Stuart Hagestad, who will be appearing in his third Masters next week at Augusta National. Okay, so right, Bob asked earlier about the third versus the first. But first of all, what was it like to hear your name, four plays, Stuart Hagestad now driving, and to actually hear that for the first time, and to have the ball on the ground and ready to hit your opening shot on that Thursday in 2017 at Augusta National? Were you nervous?
I was more nervous on Wednesday night. Well, not Wednesday night, Wednesday afternoon, because there was a weather delay and you were kind of forced to just. I will say, confidence and security from knowing that I've done everything I can to prepare as well as I can.
Mm-hmm.
So for me to basically not have that opportunity to kind of eliminate and alleviate nervous energy Wednesday afternoon was tough. So that was a challenge, which obviously we got through. But I think just having kind of the understanding at the time that, you know, hey, if you play great, awesome. And if you don't, you still played in the tournament, which is an incredible life accomplishment and experience. That took away a little bit of the nervousness and maybe a little bit of just allowing you, even at an incremental small way, just to allow yourself to free up a little bit. Certainly I was nervous. But at the same time, you know, it's just golf. And, I was more nervous Monday and Tuesday just because you're playing in front of people and there's a lot more people that are on property than maybe you kind of try and trick yourself that, you know, the difference between playing in front of a couple hundred and 25,000 is different or not that different, but it is. So, yeah. And I think that all human beings are naturally kind of, you know, inclined to care what other people think of you. And certainly when it comes to something you've put so much mental capacity and hours of your life into, you know, if you don't necessarily hit a good shot, you know, or you make a poor swing, you're immediately kind of thinking, you know, what are other people thinking? And over time, the more you do it, the goal is to make that go away, because then you can almost kind of get selfish. And that's not the right word, I think, if you don't totally understand what I mean, but in the sense of like getting into your own space and just focusing on what you need to do to play great, that's a really healthy place to be in. Doing whatever you can, obviously, to kind of go through your process and to play well versus, you know, worrying about a lot of the noise that takes place outside of that space. I was nervous, of course. It would be kind of not human if you weren't. But at the same time, you know, over the course of the round, that began to kind of to go away. And then we got into that space that I was referencing.
Yeah. And I would imagine now, this being your third Masters, just having played the golf course so many more times than you had previously, there's got to be some familiarity with the golf course, some level of obviously knowledge of the nuances. I can't imagine you're any more relaxed playing it, because it is such an incredible test of golf, but just having played it, you've got to give you some advantage, certainly over a raw, you know, amateur coming in for the first time that you were, you know, back in 17.
I mean, I think that now at 32, soon to be 33, you're more comfortable with the idea that, like, if you play well or you don't, you're still going back to the office on Monday, where the majority of the world, they care, but they don't care that much. So, like, in the sense of, like, that's healthy. And, you know, you obviously want to play well and that's great. But at the same time, like, realistically, your life probably isn't going to change that much. If you win, of course, we would love to address that if that happens. But, you know, given the alternative, like, it's probably not going to change all that much. And then from the context of, I think two things can be true at the same time. in that, you know, certainly you definitely know the golf course better. Part of the reason that your home course, that you're comfortable out there, is because you have so many positive iterations and good memories that you can kind of draw back on. So there's that, but at the same time, when the tournament starts, you know, the course gets a little spicier, firms out a little bit, greens firm up, they speed up a little bit. You know, there's obviously crowds that we've talked about. You know, there's a lot of people that you've looked up to outside of golf that are there, you know, whether it's friends, family, patrons, whoever. You talk about, you know, in the field, there's people that you've kind of looked up to for your whole life and in one part of your life. So, you know, like hitting balls on the range with Tiger, like that's a thing. Like when it's someone you've looked up to your whole life, like that's cool. But at the same time, it's kind of like, you almost have to take stock of like, hey, like, how do we feel about this? Like, okay, like we've right. So, yeah, there's a lot of little moments, that kind of take place over the week that I think, you know, you become a little bit more normalized with each day that goes by, but at the same time, I don't play for a living. So there's definitely a small learning curve. It's smaller than it was when I was 25 and playing for the first time, but at the same time, you know, it definitely still exists.
Do you have a favorite hole at Augusta?
I don't have a favorite hole. My birthday is April 10th, right? I mean, it's always kind of around Masters week. It's always been a special time. Obviously, the three of us, we all love golf. Everyone listening loves golf. Like the Masters almost kind of signifies like the start of golf season, especially as you look up into the more colder regions of the country, you know, New York, Chicago, Northeast, whatever. It's always, you know, you begin to hear the pianos and you see the commercials on TV, you know, at the start of the year and Masters kind of starts. And there's this fascination and this just total, just everyone's enamored with it. So I don't have a favorite hole per se, but I do think a couple holes that stick out that are maybe, I don't want to say underrated, but not talked about as much as maybe they should be, are 3 and 14, just given kind of the options. And 14 obviously doesn't have any bunkers, but an incredible green complex. And there's just a lot of intricacies that take place, you know, off the tee, into the green, obviously on the green. And then 3, you know, just kind of given where the pin is, they've reshaped and recontoured at very, very small, you know, incremental ways, you know, just parts of the green and, you know, to create either new pin positions or the way that the wind, you know, kind of plays up in the pines, you know, where you may not feel it. There's a lot of little things that take place. And I don't think that, you know, maybe the media goes into those as much as they could.
What do you typically hit off the tee on 3? Obviously it's a, yeah. Is that it all? It's all based on where the pin is, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. If the pin is back right.
Driver.
Really? If it's front left, what are you hitting off the tee?
3 iron.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only way, if you hit driver and the pin's front left, as firm as the greens will be, it just gets really, really tight. And the safe shot there would be to throw it more to the right. And if you do that, then you're looking at probably what ends up being a 25 or a 30 footer. Maybe you do really well and you can get it within 20, but it's glass, right? Like you're almost trying to leave it short. And under tournament speed, it's really hard to do. In my first tournament, the pin was kind of like front middle. There's like a little ridge that's there. It wasn't all the way down the left like it typically is on Sunday. And I laid it up. I hit 3 iron. It was kind of windy and blustery that day. And I threw it like at a pretty good shot, like 15, 20 feet, right? And I like tried to leave it short and I ended up rolling it 4 or 5 by. I mean, it's that's one of the putts that you kind of hear, like, you know, when Thursday rolls around, that gets faster. You know, if you're above the hole to the right, you know, kind of on, we'll say like the northwestern part of the property, but the top right corner, if you're looking at it from the fairway on 1, like that putt down, especially the front left, is so fast. And the same can be said, you know, kind of for 3. Anything above the hole on 3 on the right side is one of the quickest putts on property.
I'm just curious. Do you use your own caddy or do you use a Augusta caddy?
You know, if you go to play a practice round, then you have to use an Augusta caddy. I'm going to take one of my closest friends this year. He's going to be on the bag for me. He caddied for me in 2022 at the US Open. I don't play a ton of social golf. I love to compete. And, you know, I'm lucky that way that I kind of know what I like to do outside of work and my family. But when I've played more with him socially than just about anyone in the last 5, 6 years. He knows my game really well. Knows me really well. There's a lot of moments that kind of go into that tournament outside of maybe misreading a 25 footer by a foot. And that's not in any way to, you know, kind of belittle local knowledge at all. It's more along the lines, but like, you know, on 16, for example, if the pin's down below and I hit it on the right side, it's like, there's no caddy in the world that can give you a better read. You just shouldn't have hit it there. Right. So that was kind of my thought process is, you know, it's a special week nonetheless. And, you know, having someone that knows me really well was important to me, and hopefully it'll be kind of fundamental to overall success.
The great amateur Stuart Hagestad, who is appearing in his third Masters next week, having won the U.S. Mid-Am for the third time. I want to ask you about playing collegiately at USC. You're a Southern Cal kid. Was playing for the Trojans, was that a dream? Was that something you wanted to do collegially? How did that whole process work out? And what was that experience like playing at USC?
Well, I'll try and quickly paint a picture for you. If you grow up in Southern California, you're typically born into one of two families, like a USC or UCLA family, or, you know, somewhere else. My father went to USC and my mom went to Stanford. I went to USC and my sister went to Stanford. My brother played football at USC, and then my other brother played water polo at Stanford. So the short answer here is if I got into Stanford, talking to you, Conrad, I would have gone. And Chris Zambri knows that. So I have no issue in saying that out loud. I was not getting into Stanford, so that's okay. In middle school, that was kind of like, you know, the glory days of Pete Carroll and Matt Leinart and Reggie Bush and Londale White. And obviously, you know, I'm as big a college football fan as anyone. So, you know, growing up, going to games, that was a huge part of growing up, you know, just on Saturdays. And a lot of friends kind of growing up ended up going to USC. When I pledged a lot of, you know, with a lot of kids that I kind of grew up with and friends of mine. So, it was great. You know, I loved USC. I was in business school. I loved everything about it. I actually ended up going to graduate school and getting my MBA from there as well. So yeah, it was amazing. And then I think, and I have to give credit, you know, to Chris Zambri, that's now the head of the development team with the USGA that was just put out yesterday and announced, but a big part of my success, you know, that I've been lucky enough to have in amateur golf after school was one, I identified quickly in school, and coach kind of helped a little bit with that I knew that I loved to compete. Like, it was a huge part of my life. It was fundamental and integral to me and in a big part of me. But what coach did such a great job of was he allowed us and taught us a lot of the tools that we needed during practice to be not just efficient, but effective on the course, you know, to think about, you know, different scoring ways that you play the game and then maximizing what your best scoring abilities were. And then he gave us kind of the tools and a lot of the arrows and the quiver that I still practice with, you know, to be effective during practice and to be, you know, very measured and very kind of thoughtful with the way that when I am practicing, you know, kind of making the most of that time and not just, you know, flippantly going out and, you know, hitting balls and kind of being relatively thoughtless about it.
You're tall. 6'5" for an outstanding elite golfer. George Archer sort of comes to my mind of a Masters champion who was very tall. And you use the long putter. Have you used the long putter throughout your life? Did you start to use it more as you got taller? And if you used a regular putter, if you will, before that, what kind of putter were you with that?
I used a Newport 2, Scotty. When you're kind of growing up in junior golf and you get a circle T, or at least for us back in the day, I'm old now. Now every putter's got a great kind of select line. But if you got a circle T, it was almost like a designation of being recognized that you were a good player. So that was a big moment for us, you know, when we got our first, like, you know, circle T. And so I used that, and I putted so poorly one year at Pac-12s that I just wanted to try something else. So I thought about using a belly, or I thought about using a long putter. And I played with a friend of mine who had a long putter, didn't hate it. And then Adam had a great run before he won the Masters. And the year before, he was using, I think, what was a center shafted Futura. And he played well. I want to say he won in Palm Beach. I want to say he won at PGA National. And that kind of got my mind thinking about it. So after Pac-12s, I think it was my sophomore year, I just kind of said, screw it. Like, if we're going to make a change, like, let's just make a totally different, you know, motor skill. So I went to the long one and played in the USAM qualifier, got through, and it was kind of like, oh wow, cool. Putting became fun again, which was great. I was fine. Like, I'd still be able to go out and have fun, but at the same time, like, I would say that the long putter to use that word again. It made putting fun again. And that was really a unique feeling that I hadn't felt in a while. And there was definitely some introspection as far as like, what would people think that a 21-year-old is using a long putter, but at the same time, or 22, however old I was, but at the same time, I love to play. I love to compete. And that was the overriding factor. So it worked out okay.
Hey, Stuart, your amazing talent is affording you the opportunity not only to play in the Masters this year, but you're going to be playing down at Pinehurst in the U.S. Open. Is there any difference in the excitement level or anticipation level of a Masters or a U.S. Open?
It's a bit of a loaded question because, like, we all grew up in the United States and we all kind of put, you know, Augusta National and the Masters on a pedestal. So I'm not going to try and sugarcoat that. But at the same time, it is a major championship. I obviously have enormous respect for the USGA. I've had the chance to play on a handful of national teams, and I've obviously played in US Opens before, and a lot of good friends and mentors of mine kind of have either direct relations or roots in the USGA. So they're just different. And I think I'm pretty comfortable in saying that. When it comes to the US Open, you know, it's golf's greatest test is, I think, the motto there. So yeah, it's just a different type of challenge. And it's just as much of a mental test. I don't have a great answer here because even though they're very similar, they're also very different. But again, I think the core value that you can kind of go back to is that they're both major championships and they're both incredibly special and have their own historical ramifications and, you know, important, you know, traits and just in different ways.
One last thing from me, Stuart, and I'll let Kelly say goodbye to you. And we certainly appreciate you on Musings on Golf, a very special perspective you bring to the golf scene. Have you ever played Shinnecock?
Mm-hmm. Played the U.S. Open there.
You like it?
It's the hardest golf course I've ever played.
Yeah, I grew up about 10 miles from there and played it growing up and never thought it was anything special until 1981 when they announced the 86 U.S. Open was going to be coming there. And then as I got in the golf business and traveled around the country, many argue it's the finest U.S. Open golf course in the country. I kind of agree. I'm interested to hear that you played it and you liked it, right?
It's that playing it, if you just play the course that they set up for the members, Oakmont's probably more challenging. And then if you set up the golf course for the U.S. Open, I thought that Shinny was the hardest golf course I've ever played. I love this kind of rotation that they have, you know, Wingfoot, Oakmont, Pebble, Shinnecock comes to mind. I thought the Country Club was fantastic. Pinehurst obviously comes to mind. I think that there's, you know, a really core group of maybe you could probably get it to 5 or 7, maybe 8 different courses, you know, that when you think of what a U.S. Open should be, you know, long, tight, high rough, but like it also really rewards great shots and shot value. And I think that Shinny, you know, is kind of at the top of that list as far as what they're looking for, the identity that the U.S. Open kind of represents. And at the same time, you know, if you're lucky enough and fortunate enough to end up victorious at the end of the week, you really feel like you earned it. And you also really feel just so satisfied and fulfilled from the entire experience and the entire challenge that the golf course brings.
You know, when the USGA started the U.S. mid-amateur, have to be at least 25 years of age to play in it. So therefore it gave, you know, guys after their collegiate years an opportunity to compete. And you've had great success with that. Have you ever considered, I know you've said many times that you don't want to turn professional. Why have you continued to do this as opposed to wanting to become a tour player?
There's a bunch of reasons. Life got bigger. You know, I think that I love everyone that's turned pro and has made that profession. I think that's something that, you know, all of us kind of fantasize about growing up. And even at times, you know, when we're on the 40th page of whatever lease document you're reading, like there's definitely times where you're like, damn, I wish I was like hitting really nippy chip shots. Like that would be, you know, or I wish I, you know, was hitting a high draw into a left right wind and, you know, I pull it off. And yeah, there's definitely moments that happens. But, you know, simply put, like as I've gotten older, a lot of the people that I kind of look up to and have the chance to spend time around, they're just really impactful in different parts of their life. Obviously, you know, and sometimes they're great players. They love the game, or they've tried to leave the game better than how they found it. But, you know, they're great fathers and they're leaders and titans of industry, and they've impacted the world around them, you know, by either creating jobs or just creating some type of, whether it's shareholder value or it's value back to the community that they're in, or maybe their love is something that's philanthropic, right? And they've done something to benefit a foundation and the different organizations around them to help create the environment that they live in better. Like, not to say that you can't do that, like certainly Rory has, but Rory's a generational talent, and there's a handful of other PGA Tour players that have as well. I think the short answer is just as I've gotten older, you know, a lot of the people that I look up to has kind of changed. And I've kind of created other goals, and I've become a little bit more comfortable with the idea of not turning pro. And the other thing I'll say is, like, I don't need to play 25 times a year to scratch that itch. You know, despite what the internet thinks, I only play, with the exception of obviously this year I'm playing in the majors, I only play 6 or 7 times. You know, I don't really play in member guests. Hopefully at some point that day comes. I don't really play in four balls. I kind of have my schedule that I love to play, and that's more than enough. And then when it's time to put the clubs away, it's actually kind of a really rewarding, borderline therapeutic kind of session. Because, like, in the wintertime when you don't play, if you genuinely love golf, like, by the time we'll say March rolls around, after you put your clubs away for 2 or 3 months, you're itching to go play and practice and putt and chip and, like, want to have, like, a quality practice session. So, you know, in essence, I love golf, but part of why I love golf is because there's other stuff in my life going on.
It's a great answer. Final question for me. We like to ask our guests if they could have three others to round out a dream foursome, whether those three are still with us or they're deceased. Who would those three be for you, Stuart Hagestad, and where would you play that one dream round of golf?
Yeah, I saw this question, and I thought about it. I slept on it. I've had 2 coffees. I still don't have a good answer for you, and I know that's, like, the exact opposite of what I should say. You know, I love my dad, and I love playing with him. Dad's become a big grouch at this point in his life. He's a 15 that thinks he's a 5, and he's realistically a 20. And I've said that in front of him, so I have no fear in saying it here.
It's awesome. That's great.
No, I love my dad, so he'd have to be on that list. You know, I think I go back to the question that I just kind of mentioned. There's a lot of people that I look up to in a lot of different capacities that I love playing with and kind of picking their brain. You know, I would get my inner caucus. And we'd have a long spirited discussion with maybe a couple cocktails and get back to you on that. I thought about this. I don't have a good answer for you.
Fair enough.
It's my turn to say goodbye. And I have to express deep gratitude for your appearance here on Musings on Golf. You brought a perspective to our show that has been missing in the past. You mentioned the word member guest. I didn't want to tell you this before the interview started because I didn't want you to feel in any way intimidated. But at a member guest at Shinnecock, I did fire a 67 on Sunday, and that prompted about 374 phone calls to the USGA verifying my handicap. They thought I was a sandbagger, even though I went there as a 2.
Despite what people think, yeah, finishing second or third in those things is the best play, is the best place you can finish.
You're the greatest. Thanks, Stuart. And
thanks, guys.
I wanted the Masters, and play well down at Pinehurst.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Like you, I want to look good and perform at my best on the golf course. And that's exactly why I wear the new WH golf shoes from William & Harry, and you should too. I love these golf shoes. They're made of deer skin and calf skin. They've got a soft gel insert, and the reinforced hardened soft spikes increase stability and balance. And I got to tell you, they are so incredibly comfortable. So head on over to williamandharry.com to check out the new WH golf shoe. Look your best, play your best with William & Harry.
Well, we've been talking about the Masters, one of the finest golf courses on the planet. You want to wear the finest golf shoes on the planet? William and Harry is the name. Try them. You'll like them. You're going to look better. And I can almost guarantee you're going to play better. That's William and Harry, the leader now in golf shoes for the average player.
I did enjoy. By the way, wait a minute. For the average player, I think it can be for any player. Hey, Bob, I did enjoy wearing my William and Harry shoes at Apogee, and look forward to many more rounds with them. And when you visit WilliamAndHarry.com, select your shoes and be sure to put in the code KECHARITY and the number 10. That's KECHARITY 10. I want to thank Stuart Haggis, did Bob. I thought he was terrific, and wish him the very, very best. Next week, our guest, as we preview the 2024 Masters, is a man who knows all about winning the Masters, Larry Mize, pride of Augusta, Georgia, will be with us. For Bob Bupka, Kelly Elbin signing off. Enjoy a great week in golf before an even greater week in golf. And thanks for listening to Musings on Golf.